This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And Mike Pence is ready to go.
I am deeply humbled by your confidence. And on behalf of my family, here and gone, I accept your nomination to run and serve as Vice President of the United States of America.
And we heard that Newt Gingrich is already on board.
Donald Trump won our party's nomination because he is willing to tell the truth about the things that matter. He has a great running mate in Mike Pence.
And last night, Texas Senator Ted Cruz took his ball and bat and just went home.
If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Did you hear it there? By failing to officially endorse Donald Trump, Ted Cruz won a lot of boos from the delegate crowd. Cruz also tried to rebrand himself as the love candidate, not the angry-sounding conservative he was during the primaries, who wanted to bomb the deserts of the Middle East until they glowed. Senator Cruz presented a different vision for the future of the Republican Party than Trump, highlighting continued divisions within the party that have shown throughout this week's convention. Tonight's scripted theme, Make America One Again, could easily be changed to Make the GOP One Again. Both jobs face Donald Trump as he is expected to formally accept the party's nomination as presidential candidate after a series of happy family speeches from Trump's daughter, Ivanka, venture capitalist Peter Thiel, and Tom Barrack, the CEO of Colony Capital, who has collaborated with Trump on numerous real estate deals, but will likely not present the criticisms of many of Trump's other colleagues in regards to his business practices. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is in Cleveland watching the convention unfold. So unity tonight, they got one more shot.
Yeah, John, last night it was a convention in disarray. If the GOP was getting closer to an appearance of unity as the week went on, last night it was gone. The one big question going forward is what will Ted Cruz do next after tonight? He will be the leader of the conservative movement, will he? Even in what could be a Donald Trump presidency, will he run for president himself in 2020? It was a remarkable display. Ted Cruz booed right off the stage right after it happened. Flint Dilley, a delegate from Los Angeles, thought that Ted Cruz actually had made a big mistake.
Yeah, if you're the guy that's going to win the race in 2020, you don't fail to win the room that way.
Think it was a misread?
Yeah, I mean, but you and I both know he's what room he walked into, and they cheered him, I thought, really nicely in the beginning. I mean, I don't think he was badly, yeah, maybe you heard it differently than I did, but sounded fine in the beginning, but at some point, you got to give the audience what they want, and they want an endorsement. And if you're not going to do it, don't show up, because the fact of the matter is they signed a pledge.
So what do delegates think Cruz's next step is going to be here?
John, Rachel Chupik is a big Cruz supporter from Texas. She says, run. Ted Cruz, run for president, even if it means trying to unseat President Trump in 2020.
I would still want to see Ted Cruz run against him, and I would want to see him be the nominee and win. Challenge the incumbent, absolutely. That is a big deal. But I think, you know, Donald Trump being the nominee kind of shows us that anything is possible, and I would like to see that happen.
Well, John, not everybody agrees with that, even hardcore Cruz supporters like Dave Myers. He's from Shawnee, Kansas. He says Cruz could run, but maybe not if it's going to hurt the party more than it's already damaged, especially after this convention.
So Donald Trump has quite an assignment tonight, it would seem. He has to unite the room, which in many ways ought not to be terribly challenging, but he's also got to unite the people watching out in the United States. And that, I think, is going to be something that he has so far failed to achieve.
Yeah, that's right. So people are going to be looking for what words Donald Trump could actually speak to unite this party, especially after last night's display. But John, there's also the question of Donald Trump's entrance, his television big moment before the nation. How does Donald Trump capture the party? How does he enter the room? The other night he came out on stage, you know, WWE style mist backlighting. Can he top it? I actually asked a couple of people around the room to maybe play art director for Donald Trump. How should he enter the room tonight? Here's Dave Myers.
Well, remember, he is the master of media. and he has made a lot of money doing the reality TV show stuff. And look, let's be honest, that's where America is today. The reality TV show is what America loves. And politics, by the average American, politics is boring. So if he brings a little life and a little pizzazz to it, and he gets a few more people to listen, then so be it.
John Island Richards is a delegate from Wyoming. He runs convenience stores for a living. He has several of them. He actually wasn't too comfortable playing art director for Donald Trump's entrance.
I sell Twinkies for a living. I'm not much of an art director. I put the things on the display, and I let the customers decide what they want.
All right, but I pressed the Twinkie salesman a little bit, try to get a sense of his own flair for tonight.
Of all the things you sell, what is Donald Trump?
It's a strange question. I think he's the thing you put on your counter to get the attention of your customers. And I think that's where we're at now. And that's why he's the nominee, is because America needed to have its attention got.
What's Ted Cruz in that store, do you think?
The counter.
Solid.
Solid.
Does its job.
Does its job.
Knows why it's there.
Yep, absolutely.
Never lets you down.
No, I don't think he has. He's a pretty solid guy. When he says something, he means it.
Maybe that'll be a counter at the convenience store with that little jar on it that says tips welcome. He'll be needing some fundraising once this convention is over.
Yeah, and he's already started. John, Ted Cruz has already started his fundraising appeal after he got booed off the stage last night. He sent fundraisers out to his supporters saying the fight is not over. John, it is Trump's big entrance tonight. His last word on a convention that on more than one occasion has spun out of control. And maybe I'll give the last word here to Rachel Chupik, the pro-Cruz delegate from Texas.
He could come running out on stage screaming, "Make America Great Again," or something like that. Yeah! This is huge! Or something like that.
I like the trapeze in an eagle costume winging down from the ceiling there, Todd. What do you think?
John, I think as art director, you might be right on the money. A lot of people are going to be looking to see how does Donald Trump top himself.
Well, it'll be up to him, and there's a lot riding on this speech tonight, that's for sure. It's first and perhaps last chance to really look presidential before the big race between Trump and Hillary Clinton begins in earnest. Thanks so much, Todd Zwillick.
You got it, John.
Is there a governance issue at the Republican convention in Cleveland? On foreign policy, erratic inconsistencies are a feature of the Trump rhetoric on foreign affairs. One example, the fight in Ukraine. The GOP has traditionally backed arming the Ukrainian government forces, but that provision was removed from the party platform. And in an interview this week, Trump raised the possibility that the U.S. might not support NATO countries in the case of a Russian invasion. Trump said he would look at the situation first and wanted to see if NATO members, like the Baltic states, had lived up to their obligations to the U.S. Trump says he's more concerned with unfavorable trade agreements, terrorism, and China's economy, even at a moment when China's not doing terribly well. This vision of a more limited American role in the world is a familiar one, says Steve Clemens, editor-at-large for The Atlantic. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick spoke with Clemens in Cleveland.
You're getting, like it or not, in Donald Trump, a Republican version of where Barack Obama is. People go crazy when I say that. But when you look at where Hillary Clinton has traditionally been, she's going to be much closer in the foreign policy interventionist goal to where George W. Bush was than where Barack Obama is. But the Trump-Manafort partnership is much, much more in line with where President Obama expressed himself in his Atlantic cover story with Jeff Goldberg on the Obama doctrine, which was one of restraint.
And this isn't just the Steve Clemens liberal death hug of Donald Trump's very Obama-like national security strategy.
No, that is not. He was the only presidential candidate running who came out and said on the first day of his office he would not rip up the Iran deal. He says, you know, when you make deals, you don't rip them up. You can renegotiate them, you can come back, you can do whatever, but you don't rip them up. You have to, it's not what we all necessarily think about what Trump is saying. It's understanding his mindset. It is an interesting frame when you look at how America is going to negotiate the next phase of its engagement with the rest of the world. We probably need to do that, no matter whether Hillary Clinton wins or Donald Trump wins. The United States needs to negotiate a new social contract with other great rising powers in the world, because what we've had in the past with our institutions isn't working. I want to give Trump some limited credit. I mean, I don't think most people in the hall would like me giving Donald Trump for credit or anything. It would harm him. So Hillary Clinton can thank me later. But I think you got to give Donald Trump credit for at least, you know, putting those terms out there, that some of the arrangements we have no longer fit with the world that we see out there.
Hillary Clinton shouldn't thank you, because if enough former Sanders supporters who are liberals
hear this
conversation and say that one of the things they hate about Hillary Clinton is she's too hawkish, she's tilted too far towards Israel, we need to change these arrangements, and they're independent and they're also mad about trade and all of the other economic factors,
you're giving them
a reason to say that Trump might be okay.
Well, no, this is really fundamental to understanding Trump. I have about 100 second and third cousins in Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas. Please, folks, don't look them up, because it's complicated. But about 97 of them support Donald Trump, and I've just been flabbergasted as to why. They're not dumb people. They're not racist. What they are, however, are families that have had a heavy role in fighting America's wars in the past. And a lot of their children have gone off to fight wars or have gone into different phases and have come back and had trouble economically, had trouble finding jobs. There is an anger out there that, you know, in the old days, the quid pro quo was America played this unique role of global cop and it got a benefit economically for working citizens. That quid pro quo is broken. We go fight wars, China wins, is the way they see that. There's a side to this where those angry Bernie Sanders supporters who are frustrated economically, and they're also frustrated with, if we're going to play this role out there, why aren't we getting more for it? And they converge. That's where Trump and Bernie Sanders converge.
Steve Clemens, Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
I really care about Fox, and I really care about Roger. And he's been nothing but good to me. And he's been very loyal, and he's had my back.
That's Megyn Kelly, Fox's biggest star. And everyone over at Fox News maybe needs to get their backs checked, as the network looks like an episode of Game of Thrones this week. Evil genius Roger Ailes has until August 1st to leave his throne at Fox News. That's according to the Murdochs, those well-heeled Lannisters who are determined to oust him in response to growing allegations of sexual harassment. Allegations, now lawsuits, and corroborated this week by Fox's star, Megyn Kelly, who gets some primo payback from the man who's been nothing but good to her. Ouch. Ailes' alleged sexual appetite makes him a fairly ordinary male executive, but he is a one-of-a-kind for the way he went from Nixon media advisor to grand architect of the GOP's brand on television. The Fox network is hugely profitable and influential at the same time. But empires can vanish in a flirtatious and horny instant. Gabriel Sherman is national affairs editor for New York Magazine and author of The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. He says Ailes' demise matches the coup-like power shift going on right now in the GOP.
Well, Roger Ailes is 76 years old, and you know what's so striking about this week's shocking turn of events is, in a certain way, how not surprising it should be. You know, I wrote a biography of Roger Ailes that came out in 2014. And in my book, I quoted multiple women on the record saying that they had been sexually harassed by him through the years. And the book documents many examples of his domineering and ruthless management style, his willingness to cut corners. We should point out he was forced out of NBC in the mid-1990s amidst an external legal investigation into his management. So this is not surprising. I guess what's surprising is that he was able to hold on to power so long. And now, in 1 week, in one span of a few days, it's all coming to an end. It's just, I cannot wrap my head around it.
In a sense, this is kind of power versus power, because it can be argued that Megyn Kelly has become the one talent figure at Fox that's bigger than Ailes.
Well, that is really, you know, this election cycle, yes, there is a degree of that. You know, her feud with Donald Trump catapulted her into the mainstream consciousness. And she, we should point out, is in the midst of a contract renegotiation with Fox News. And so her star has risen to a point where she is one of the only Fox News personalities who feels that she could challenge Ailes openly. And she went, as I reported, to the investigators hired by Rupert Murdoch to look into the sexual harassment allegations. And she testified to the lawyers that she, too, endured harassment by Ailes 10 years ago.
Which was an absolute sort of nail in the coffin on that. The other person who could possibly challenge Ailes is Bill O'Reilly, but he's also, his status is unknown at the network right now.
Yeah, Bill O'Reilly has publicly in recent days hinted that he would consider retirement after his current contract expires following the election. We should point out, though, that O'Reilly has taken Ailes' side in the scandal. But, you know, there is probably some personal stakes involved because back in 2004, Bill O'Reilly himself was embroiled in a really messy and sordid sexual harassment scandal when a former producer of his accused him and actually tape recorded him making really gross comments on a phone call in late night conversations. So Ailes defended O'Reilly at the time, and now O'Reilly is coming to Ailes' defense. And I wouldn't be surprised if following Ailes' departure, once O'Reilly's contract expires, that he too, you know, seeks an exit.
The reason that Ailes was probably impregnable was, well, the reason that Ailes was probably unassailable in his power was because he had done everything the Murdochs had ever wanted the Fox network to do. It succeeded on conservative credentials. It succeeded in being relevant to the political conversation. And as you said in your book, it divided a country. What turned?
A couple things turned. Ailes, yes, succeeded, especially on the financial front. Fox News's profits generate a quarter of Rupert Murdoch's total profit for his media empire. So he needs Fox News to power the rest of his ambitions. But what changed was the rise principally of his two adult sons, James and Lachlan Murdoch, who, well, yes, they're sort of conservative. Their politics are far to the center of where their fathers are. And as they've moved into executive ranks and have been anointed as the heirs apparent to the empire, they've decided that they now have the leverage to move against Ailes. They don't want Fox's divisive, polarizing style of politics to be the face of their family's company. And so they, in many ways, have used this scandal as a pretext to achieve a long-held goal, which was moving Ailes aside.
And whether there's a personal issue there or not, it makes all the strategic sense in the world for the younger Murdochs to not want an angry white male face from the Nixon era to be fronting their network. That just makes no sense.
Yeah, you know, I'm on the ground in Cleveland, and I think what makes this what freights this story with so much historical resonance is that this is in many ways the same tortured soul searching that the Republican Party is going through. You know, the collapse of this coalition that Roger Ailes had helped Richard Nixon. We should point out Roger Ailes was Richard Nixon's chief media advisor in the 68 campaign. He advised him on his television performances, and so this coalition of whites and conservative Democrats that Nixon put together in 68 as a backlash to the counterculture is really starting to fracture as you see the intellectual and mainstream conservative sides of the party break away from Trump. And Fox News has been at the center of that cleavage. And so it makes sense that the Murdochs, the younger Murdochs, I should say, want to be on the other side of history. They've decided that whatever comes after Trump, it's not going to be Fox News.
Finally, and this is the sort of New York City media piece here that you guys at New York Magazine are so good at. It appears that Ailes will probably get his full $40 million payout, depending on what the legal matter is. His contract would probably have accounted for at least some of this kind of, you know, misbehavior, although not explicitly sexual harassment. And he cannot probably get a cab in town today, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, what's fascinating is I'm getting calls from Fox News employees who are describing this almost like the end of a regime when an authoritarian regime collapses. As we've seen in the past, it doesn't go slowly, it goes quickly. And so power is this elusive thing. Ailes maintained it. He was a student of power, but it slipped from his grasp. And now people see that he is vulnerable. And it's just, like you said, so stunning that it happened in the span of a week.
Sharks are circling Roger Ailes here in New York City and around the media world. Gabriel Sherman is National Affairs Editor for New York Magazine and author of The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Whatever you want to say about the crimes of Syria's Bashar al-Assad, he's still in power in Damascus after 5 years of war and 400,000 people dead.
If you have a doctor who cut the head because of a gangrene to save the patient, you don't say he's a brutal doctor. He's doing his job in order to rest, to save the rest of the body. So when you protect your country from the terrorists and you kill terrorists and you defeat terrorists, you're not brutal. You are a patriot. That's how you look at yourself, and that's how the people want to look at you.
In an interview with NBC News, President Assad uses that colorful metaphor of amputation as cure for the people of Syria. The people of Syria might also ask, what is the U.S. mission right now in Syria? That became a more difficult question to answer this week when an American airstrike killed more than 100 civilians in the town of Manbij And when a video surfaced that seemed to show U.S.-backed rebels beheading a 12-year-old refugee in Aleppo that they claimed was a Palestinian pro-government fighter. And with Turkey recovering from a coup attempt to the north, suddenly there are new positive and negative signs to sort through in the Middle East. Rami Khoury is director of the Islam Affairs Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Assad, he says, has been able to survive in a war of attrition, but time is no longer on his side.
Well, it looks good to him in the short run, actually, rather than the long run. I think he's realized that he's been able to stay in power. He's got the Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah supporting him. He's got the trickle of some countries around the world, including in Europe, coming back and talking to him and, you know, rekindling diplomatic relations and sort of not isolating him as much. So he feels confident, but he's really in a very weak position. He controls about maybe a quarter of his country, and he can only stay in power with massive Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah military and financial assistance. So he seems strong, but he's actually very weak and very vulnerable. And that's why the U.S. and others, the Europeans now, are jumping into the diplomatic arena to try. They figure that he is actually weak in the longer, medium run, long run, and they want to work with the Russians to try to figure out, can they start a political transition?
Is there any long-term diplomatic settlement here that would maintain the current borders of Syria and not partition it into three districts?
I think it's absolutely sure that the country will remain within its present borders. What happens inside those borders will change in the sense that you're likely to get very decentralized government with much more local autonomy, like the Kurds have autonomy in northern Iraq, and you'll have autonomous regions that are linked together to maintain the Syria that we know today in its present borders, but with a very different power-sharing structure. And a very different government system, we hope.
And would that include some sort of political collaboration between ISIS, which controls territory in Syria, and the Assad government?
Oh, absolutely not. ISIS is going to disappear sometime in the next, probably, I would guess, year. They will be beaten back out of Raqqa and eventually then out of Mosul in Iraq. The problem is that the underlying drivers of discontent and desperation across the Arab world that caused tens of thousands of people to join ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Qaeda affiliate in Syria, or many other groups like that, those underlying conditions and drivers are still there. So ISIS will be defeated in Raqqa and Mosul, but the forces that create ISIS are still around, and something else will probably take their place. In other words, there will be continued dynamics of turbulence, disruption, violence, probably some terrorism. And this will only be resolved in the long run when you get a genuine power-sharing system in countries like Syria, like Iraq, other countries. And that's when you have calm and stability, and then you can have development and prosperity, and you don't have the thousands and thousands of desperate young men going to groups like ISIS.
Why does the U.S. appear to be so involved in a confused and ineffective quagmire right now in its air power and the mission that it seems to be carrying out that no one can explain?
The U.S. just is not really politically, psychologically, temperamentally, or intellectually able to engage in the kind of combination of diplomacy, peace building, and military actions that are needed to succeed in the Middle East. And that's why I think Obama was more or less right to not to get too much more involved and try to get out of the region militarily, because it was the American involvement was just creating more problems for the U.S. and more problems for the people of the region. And you see that everywhere the U.S. was involved militarily, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, you have a mess now, a terrible, you know, awful situation. So I think the situation calls for a better approach that uses more diplomacy and really looks at the underlying problems and tries to solve them in the way that South Africa was resolved, Northern Ireland was resolved, other conflicts were resolved when people looked at the actual underlying problems. What was the problem and solve it politically?
Finally, is the instability in Turkey or the changes that are taking place, maybe it's not instability, it's more of Erdogan, is that an opportunity for the refugees? Is that an opportunity for the humanitarian crisis? Does that positively or negatively affect that situation?
It's too early to tell what's going to happen in Turkey, but clearly we have to keep a careful eye on it. And what happens in Turkey now is partly dependent on how they pursue their Syrian policies. They have a kind of a maturity and a decisiveness that most other countries in the Middle East don't have. And we'll have to see how Erdogan responds now to the internal situation and how he deals with regional issues, the Kurds, Syria, and fighting ISIS. Those are the three interlinked issues that he has to deal with right now. And most of the signs so far have been in the last, say, 2 or 3 years that the Turks have not dealt with these issues very well. They're going to have to rethink what their policies are going to be. And it's possible that Turkey's evolution now may create more problems in the region and more warfare, or they may actually lead to a stabilization and pushing people to actually go and really address those underlying issues and solve them in a way that is acceptable to everybody.
Rami Khoury is senior fellow at the Issam Ferhez Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Rami, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a question. What TV show did entertainment powerhouse Lucille Ball save from cancellation that was not I Love Lucy? The answer is Star Trek. This one is even better. Who convinced actress Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura in the original Star Trek, to stay with the show even though she was the only African-American in the cast? That would be Martin Luther King Jr. Oh, yeah.
The stories will involve human beings in jeopardy, sometimes me. I play Captain Kirk of the spaceship.
Many such galactic gems are to be found in a massive book, The 50-Year Mission, the complete uncensored, unauthorized oral history of Star Trek, the first 25 years. Actors, writers, producers, and just about anyone who's worked on this cult classic. Journalist Edward Gross is co-author of this authoritative tome and says that the little starship that could, that Lucy, of all people, saved, went on to save the universe.
They were a show that was struggling to stay on the air for all three seasons that it was on. It was threatened with cancellation in season one, threatened with cancellation in season two, and then fell apart in season three, even though they got their last season, which gave them enough episodes for syndication. So I don't think you could be in that environment and actively think, well, people don't appreciate it now, but someday they're going to appreciate this.
Is there a consensus in this group of what episode is the best or the one that captured what Star Trek was trying to say about the future?
Devil in the Dark was the episode with the Horta. And that's the
right
now everybody says, oh, the Horta, you know, and everyone goes to that as one of the classic episodes. But I think it's really symbolic of where we are as a society in the future. You know, in the sense of, here's this creature. It's killing people. It's wiping people out. But then we find out that the reason it's doing it is because what the miners are mining are its children, its eggs. So in the end, it's saying, this is an intelligent being. It's different from us, but it needs to survive. We're the ones who are the enemies. We're in its territory.
Tons of references to The City on the Edge of Forever.
The classic episode.
Which has Joan Collins.
Right.
I actually interviewed Joan Collins about being in that episode.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, she's so proud of it.
She should be.
Yeah.
It's a great episode. Harlan hates it.
Harlan Ellison,
the writer who wrote the original script, despises the episode.
Why does Spock call you captain? Were you in the war together?
We served together.
And you don't want to talk about it? Why? Did you do something wrong? Are you afraid of something?
And the reason he hates it is because, you know, at the end of the episode, Joan Collins is crossing the street. Edith Keeler is crossing the street. A truck is approaching. Now, Kirk has the choice. I save her or I let her die. And he ultimately chooses to throw himself into Bones, you know, McCoy's arms, and she dies. In Harlan's original story, he was willing to go and sacrifice everything for love. And Spock stopped him from doing so.
What's the real story on the relationship between the originals and the TNGs, the Next Generation?
Well, it was very interesting because when the show began, when Next Generation began, they were all against it. They came out very publicly against it, the actors. I mean, they were still making the movies. So I think they felt, and with good reason, I think, after all the years of people, you know, proclaiming them as gods of television, that they were Star Trek. and the idea of trying to do it with somebody else was insulting to them, and it would never work as far as they were concerned.
Yeah, right, because they were using real actors like Patrick Stewart as opposed to Shatner, who...
Hey, don't mess with the Shat. That's all I can tell you.
Did you spend a lot of time with Shatner?
I've spent some time. He's not a very talkative fellow. He's a funny guy in the sense of if you get him in a great mood, he does a great interview. If you get him in a bad mood, he does one-word answers. It's very, very interesting. Yeah.
My favorite of the movies, the Wrath of Khan movie is fantastic. Corrected all of the mistakes of the first movie.
Oh, absolutely. Because the first movie was trying to be something very different from what even the episodes were. It embraced the notion of going out in space. And the notion of humanity taking the next step. It really embraced it and tried to deal with some serious ideas. It just did it in a slow manner.
The Whale movie is fantastic.
The Voyage Home.
Voyage Home.
And it's very funny because a lot of people dismiss that one. It's really a good movie, and it really captures Star Trek.
Got great lines. I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
Who are you?
Who do you think I am?
Don't tell me. You're from outer space.
No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
Great line.
Absolutely.
And when Chekhov goes, take us to the nuclear vessels.
The nuclear vessels.
The nuclear vessels. Take us. And he's asking cops this. And this is in the middle of the 80s, at the height of the Reagan sort of Cold War. So the idea that a Russian person.
And they have that cop just staring at him.
Yeah.
But you know what's so good about it is they have all the funny lines. But there's a moment between Shatner and Catherine Hicks.
Who plays the Iowa teacher.
Right. Well, the marine biologist.
Right, marine biologist, right. Exactly.
And they're in the Klingon ship, and they've turned the ship into a tank, and they're looking at the whales. And Shatner just delivers a line like, you know, it's ironic.
You know, it's ironic when man was killing these creatures, he was destroying his own future.
Now, that may not seem like much of a line, but that embodies Star Trek. Observing our modern behaviors and projecting it into the future.
What's the story with Roddenberry? They thank him in every movie. Is he a happy person? Is he someone who is abused by the studio? Is he a visionary? He certainly seems to have owned the rights to everything because he's got his name on everything.
Roddenberry is a visionary. He came up with Star Trek. He came up with the concept of Star Trek. And that alone allows him to, you know, warrants any sort of praise that wants to be thrown on him. The problem is that as good a visionary as he is, his writing didn't match his vision in the sense of he needed other people to help guide Star Trek. And he did. Like Gene L. Kuhn came in the middle of first season of the show. And if you look at the episodes, he was there for about a year. And if you look at the episodes, he really honed in on what Star Trek is, which takes nothing away from Roddenberry as the creator of Star Trek.
So let's end on Nimoy. It seemed when I saw the Whale movie, that he'd totally come around, that he basically had recognized that was a thing to value and that his career really took off when he reintegrated Spock back into his life.
But the thing was, in the 70s, every one of those actors struggled. So you have these guys who can't break away from the image of Star Trek or the baggage of Star Trek and yet need to work. They need to keep going forward. And Leonard Nimoy, if you look at that time period, he busted his butt. But then when they wanted to make the first movie, he had them in the position where, well, you're going to have to settle this with me or I'm not doing the movie. And yet the first movie was a miserable experience for him and everybody because it was just such a long process and the end results everybody hated at the time. Wrath of Khan, Harve Bennett, who took over from Roddenberry as producer, said, well, what if we kill Spock? What if we give you the opportunity to play your death scene? And Nimoy liked that. Not that he hated the character of Spock, but he figured, all right, I'll come back one more time and give him a dignified exit. So he came back, and he had such a good time that he came back. He said, I'll come back for three. I want to direct. And they said yes.
Edward Gross is the co-author of The 50-Year Mission, the complete, uncensored, unauthorized oral history of Star Trek the first 25 years.
Thanks so much for having me.
And your favorite Star Trek character?
Hi, this is Robert from Colorado. For me, it's the original Spock. I not only like the premise of the character being from a logic society, but I like Leonard Nimoy's portrayal.
Mr. Spock, are you all right?
Yes, I believe no permanent damage was done.
What happened?
The occipital area of my head seems to have impacted with the arm of the chair.
No, Mr. Spock, I meant what happened to us?
That we have yet to ascertain.
Lincoln.
No brains were hurt in the making of this program. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Take us with you. You can subscribe to The Takeaway podcast and give us a rating. Find us on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.